You're listening to the 7 Deadly Investor Traps featuring Leba Ostro. Ms. Ostro is the owner of Ostro Financial Group in Houston, Texas. Leba, are these traps only the mega wealthy can fall prey to, or do these traps affect every investor level?
I think they affect every investor level, and it really varies depending on the school of thought that a client has. So as we go through the deadly traps, we might have different impressions for different people. I'll give you an example. Some of my clients think that diversity means that they have a whole bunch of stuff. And when we do the analysis of what diversity really is, they find out they have really many times common holdings in totally different name brand instruments. And they're surprised. Another one is their activity of their portfolio. Some people think being real busy trading in and out is active management, and it's active, but it's active for the IRS, and it's active for the registered rep, and not necessarily serving the client. Then we talk about risks, and we ask clients all the time, do you have a sense of your true risk tolerance of your portfolio? And they say yes, and we go into a conversation, and they are clueless, absolutely have no idea what level of risk they're really playing in. Then we talk about coaching versus being a broker. And we all the time visit with clients, and they don't realize who their broker is working for. And the truth is, the broker's working for the brokerage house. And many times, brokerage houses have proprietary products. What does that mean? It means sometimes they're getting larger amounts of compensation for selling homegrown products. In our firm, we coach our clients. We have no compensation coming from commission-based products. And because of what we do, we are coaching the client on what's appropriate for their portfolio. And none of it comes from commission-based instruments when it's assets under management.
Tell me about being a coach.
Up until not too terribly long ago when I met Mark, I said I was a financial planner. But in reality, I really have always been a coach. And some of the people that have been my clients for 15, 20 plus years know I've coached them all along the way, whether it was helping them figure out what was the appropriate way to fund college for their children or to buy their second home or even should they buy or lease their car. So I have been a coach. I just didn't call myself that.
You coach financially for all walks of life, but you've also created the Senior Care Advisors of Texas. You did that in 2005.
It is an organization that does far more than the coaching for financial instruments. We are an organization that is a Texas nonprofit corporation that offers complimentary consultation and needs assessment for the adult children of seniors or the seniors themselves in every facet of senior living, whether it's care in their home, whether it's reviewing their portfolio, whether it's helping them pick out the Medicare Part D that is appropriate, paying their bills, finding a facility that's appropriate to live in, and so on. We're over 20 different disciplines that give complimentary consultation to find the appropriate whatever that's needed in their family. As the founder, when I'm wearing my hat as a senior care advisor person, I'm visiting with them as a certified senior advisor, and I'm asking all the questions. I'm asking the questions that they don't even know to ask. Our tagline in Senior Care Advisors is, because you don't know what you don't know. And that journey came out of being the adult child of three and now my fourth parent. And all the surprises that we get as our parents are aging differently and longer. When I'm wearing the Ostro financial hat, it's because there's a financial need to assist. But they're totally separate entities.
Whatever hat you're wearing, the clients that you meet with, are they aware that these seven traps exist and ignore them? Or do you find that they really weren't able to articulate these traps until you point them out to them?
I think you get a mixed bag. Sometimes I get a aha. Sometimes I get a denial. Sometimes I get a surprise. But when they go through the process and they're educated, for the most part, 6 to 7 of the traps are agreed upon.
So making the investor aware of these traps seems to be step number one.
I think it's important to define them. Instead of talking in roundabouts, when we do face-to-face visits with people, we actually define each one of the traps and have a dialogue about whether it's something that's been a concern of theirs or not. My existing clients really didn't have most of the traps because they've been working with us anyway. And one of my favorite ones is the I'm going to hold this till I get even, which really is a matter of controlling someone's emotional handling of the portfolio versus their intellectual. And even my most brilliant clients, once they've gone through part of the process, admit that I take the emotion out of their portfolio because I'm the analytical side of it.
But Lee, but why shouldn't I be emotionally attached to my portfolio? It is, after all, for many of us, our 401k, our future.
I agree, but if you're emotionally attached to something, then you're not going to keep it well balanced, asset allocated. And the famous line is, everybody knows they need to buy low, sell high. How many people really do that? None. They do the herd mentality. People do what feels good in their gut and in their emotions. So what do? They get a hot tip in the locker room, men's and women's locker room. They buy a great stock. And it's easy, quite honestly, to buy a great stock. But when do you sell the stock? Well, it's rallying and doing great, so you're euphoric. Time goes on and the stock tanks. Then emotions kick in. Oh boy, I'm going to keep this until it at least gets back to break even. One of my wealthiest clients is still holding on to what I call the dog stock. And every time we review it and he owns it, he bought it with his play money, not his serious money. I have his serious money. He has his play money. It's his go to Vegas in the stock market money. And he keeps holding on to it. And eventually he'll dump it, maybe. And maybe not. Maybe he's just going to hold it forever until it breaks even or it plunges. Everybody agrees initially on a plan. And then I get the client who calls and says, oh, I heard about this great company that's going to go public. Or they are listening to what Mark says so beautifully is financial pornography. My husband was hysterical when he heard that. But it's really true. You listen to CNBC or these talk shows. And what I say to my clients early on is, how do you think these radio stations and newspapers and magazines make their money? They don't make it from the stock market. They make it by hype, by scaring people, getting them to buy their publications, listen to their channels, and they have to do it by selling fear. People have fear, and they play on it. So when we're finished with a client, other than a major, major life-changing event, my clients don't change their asset allocation. They stay the course. So unless they inherit a large amount of money or they have a major personal expenditure that's coming up, there's no reason to change the course. And that's what we do for them.
So what are the biggest problems investors must confront and conquer? For the next few minutes of this program, here is Seven Deadly Investor Traps author Mark Matson to unveil the traps.
These seven deadly traps are so important because they literally spell the death to your portfolio. They kill off your returns. They rob you of safety and security. They end up killing your life dreams from the inside out. What these seven deadly traps do, because they're so devastating and heinous in nature, they create a lot of stress and a lot of anxiety. And they create a tremendous amount of chaos in the lives of the people that suffer from them. So this is the irony of our age. We live in a time of great abundance, of great financial wealth. We live in the renaissance of all human endeavors with more wealth in the United States today than in any other period of history and culture. And yet we live with growing amounts of personal stress, personal anxiety, and personal chaos.
What are you saying that each investor should try to do effectively?
The goal of any investor is to use their money, their assets, to reach their life dreams. You know, the things that they hold valuable, their hopes, to help them live a more rich and fulfilling life. I mean, that's the ultimate goal of any investor. Unfortunately, these seven deadly traps rob them of the ability to do that because they squander their assets in a myriad of ways that are very good for the financial community at large because they have ways of making a lot of money off of your assets, but not too good for the investor. Because what we're going to see as we look at these seven deadly traps is that we're basically speaking out against a whole financial industry, a brokerage industry that has developed that takes advantage of the lack of information and the lack of prudent investing by the average investor and even very sophisticated investors. Let me share a little bit of my own practical experience in the financial world. This is really my personal story. I always had a dream, even from the time I was very young, to be able to graduate from college, and I did get a degree in both finance and another degree in accounting from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. And my goal was to be able to help people invest their money wisely to reach their life dreams. I went to work as a financial advisor. As part of that position, I also got hooked up with a brokerage firm. As a major part of my job, what I wanted to do is help people make wise investments, prudent investments to grow their wealth. And I figured that this was a relatively easy task for anyone that was bright and wanted to spend enough time to educate themselves on the subject. While I didn't have the ego or the arrogance to think that I knew what the best stocks would be, surely I felt that I would be able to find the best managers by studying past performance, by looking at different charts, by listening to my broker-dealer to tell me which one were the best managers. And then if I could just help my clients, therefore, diversify their assets a little bit so they wouldn't lose it all in one or two speculative ventures. And then at the same time, if I could then find the best managers to place their money with, that this would give us a very successful investment experience and everybody would be very happy and I would have done a lot to help people reach their goals. I must say that even as I began this journey of helping people find these so-called best managers to put their money with, there was a nagging suspicion in the back of my mind, a question that continued to haunt me, which was, no matter how brilliant any single individual was, how is it that one individual can consistently and predictably do better than everybody else? So this was always something that was in the back of my mind, even as I was picking out these so-called great managers. But I figured, hey, the numbers aren't going to lie. I mean, obviously, if someone's done this 10, 20, or sometimes even 30 years in a row, that this is going to be a good indicator of their performance into the future. How can you argue with the numbers? If they've done it 20 years in a row, they'll probably be able to do it in the next 20 years. You know, we had all these brilliant people marched out in front of us at the conventions wearing their $1,500 suits and their $1,200 pair of shoes. They would be marched out in front of us as, you know, these brilliant gurus who could pick all the best stocks and who knew which way the market was going to go. Not only that, but they also would pay for us to go on vacations. We would go to Hawaii or we'd go to Europe or, if you sold enough of their funds and their investments, they would pay for these junkets all over the country. What I found after a very short period of time is that we would place money with these managers, sometimes that had 10, 20, even 30 years of stellar track record. Then what would happen is I'd look at their performance versus a standard benchmark like the S&P 500 if they were managing large company stocks or the Russell 2000 if they were managing small company stocks. And what I was finding is that no matter how great they were in the past, the vast majority of the managers we would pick out were underperforming the index that they were supposed to beat. Not only that, but I was finding that the manager that was so stellar was just as likely to be in the bottom 10% of all managers as they were the top 10% of all managers. At the same time, we were also told by the brokerage firms and the large financial institutions that commissions were by far the best way to help your clients. And we were told that, you know, commissions are great, commissions are okay, and yes, technically you work for us, we're the brokerage firm, but you can still make the best recommendations for your clients. Of course, we were still given all kinds of incentives to sell specific products, specific stocks, specific mutual funds that were going to make the broker-dealers and other people more money. So we were incentivized to sell products, not necessarily to give our clients peace of mind. And I became very disgruntled. And I'm giving you that insider look of what the brokerage world looks like. When we go to the conventions and we talk to these people, very seldom do we hear talk about how to help investors have peace of mind, how to have investors really understand what they're doing, how to build truly diversified portfolios. It was basically, hey, these are the top managers. Look how great they are. Dump your clients' money in these things and they'll continue to beat the market in the future. And what I found out as a broker inside the industry, as a financial planner, that the system just didn't work. It was making the brokerage firms a lot of money, making the mutual funds a lot of money, making the people that were putting out the stocks lots of money, but it wasn't making and delivering what we talked to the investors about providing.
So it worked for the industry, but not for the investors.
Exactly. Not only did I see that, but I also saw that the investors' problems, the fact that they ended up gambling and speculating with their money, many times they didn't know that they were, but they were putting it in a mutual fund that would then buy and sell and churn their portfolios so sporadically and so hyperactively that the manager was gambling with their money. They thought they were buying a long-term investment, but the mutual fund would turn over 100 or 200% in a year, meaning that all the stocks are bought and sold and churned consistently. So they thought they were prudently investing for a long-term strategy, and yet the managers they were trusting were churning their portfolios, speculating and gambling with their money. I found this to be a very devious, intellectually dishonest way to manage people's money. Because the very thing that was destructive, the problems that the investors had, were the profits for the industry. And this conflict of interest was very seldom talked about, if ever. It was kind of the dirty little secret in the industry that no one wanted to address and no one wanted to bring out. I needed to know why this was happening. So the first people I went to were the brokerage firms that I worked for, the broker-dealer I worked for, and I went to the mutual fund companies that had, you know, sold me this bill of goods because I had bought it hook, line, and sinker at that point. And I said, what's going on here? Why is this happening? Why are these brilliant managers that have done so well for 10, 20, 30 years, why is it that their performance is so consistently poor and that my investors are suffering? And what I was given was what I like to call weak pseudo-psychobabble. You know, things like, well, our economic forecasts and models do not integrate many external unknowable combinations of XYZ events. Basically, the jargon was, our prediction of the future wasn't accurate and we lost your money. Duh. I mean, isn't the very nature of the future to be unknowable? That just added to my own personal anguish and pain and frustration about not being able to truly help my clients. What I found is that finally coming to terms with understanding the problem and being basically a victim, because I firmly believe that not only are the investors themselves victims, but many of the brokers are also victims of the illusions and the intellectual dishonesty of the industry. Not only do the investors struggle and suffer, but also the brokers struggle and suffer because they are basically pawns in a game where they can't win either. So this is destructive, not just for the investor, but also for the brokers and the brokerage firms. Luckily, answers come from the most unlikely places. I was at a conference in San Francisco, and I went to hear a debate between an active money manager, a hyperactive manager that believes that they could consistently and predictably beat the market year after year by picking the best stocks and forecasting what was going to happen, and an academic whose name is Rex Singfeld. And the basic nature of this debate was, should you actively manage money with managers trying to predict and forecast the future, or should you rather invest your money that brought a broad cross-section of an asset category that was designed to then give the market rate of return and eliminate the additional trading involved in trying to predict and forecast? I went in very skeptical, really not knowing which side to believe or understand. And as I listened to this debate, it became exceedingly clear to me that I had found the answer of why none of these gurus could consistently repeat their performance. And as Rex pointed out, that in a free market left to the nature of supply and demand, and basically comes back to the very understanding of capitalism, that all of the market participants will take the knowable and predictable information that's out there, and also the unknowable and unpredictable information, their feelings, their thoughts, their ideas, their plans for the future. And that in a free market of supply and demand, and that the price for any stock or security would be in effect the best possible price. In other words, free markets work. All the knowable and predictable information about the future is already factored into the price. Therefore, only unknowable and random events into the future would change prices going forward. This was a landmark moment for me because it explained why the managers couldn't repeat. Because if all the knowable and predictable information is already in the price, it's only random luck that's going to make prices change going forward. In other words, the manager that had the stellar performance was very much like an orangutan throwing darts or flipping coins to pick their stocks in the past, and that their performance was much more a factor of luck than it was of actual skill. As a matter of fact, I came to learn that a manager's ability to pick the best stocks or get lucky enough to have the best stocks in the past has zero correlation with their ability to repeat that into the future, because it's pure blind random luck. This explained a lot. What this meant to investors was that all the buying and selling, all of the trading, all of the hyperactive activity inside of the mutual fund, all of the things that we were all told and that investors are told today is going to make their money is paramount to actually speculating and gambling with their money and paying a huge cost to do it. My revelation, and I hope the one that you have today listening to this program, is that free markets work.
If I go ahead then, and I'm an investor, and I believe what my broker is telling me, or what my firm is telling me about the research, and because they do so much research, and they are such educated people, they can go ahead and tell me what is going to happen in the market, and why this is best for me. Does that mean I'm naive? Does that mean because I'm listening to them, I'm not very smart, and I'm just going ahead and following blindly to someone who's not telling me the truth?
I want to kind of get that myth out of the way right up in front, because it's a great question. And believing that someone out there, whether it's you or the broker or some money manager that's on the cover of a magazine, can actually predict and forecast the future and pick all the best stocks is not the folly of weak minds. It is the folly of very brilliant minds. It's almost to the fact where the Greeks talk about this idea called hubris, and hubris is believing that you're far more powerful than you actually are and paying a terrible price. Well, people that have very high intellects often feel that they can beat all kinds of games. They feel like they can beat Vegas odds. They feel like they can pick the winner of the Super Bowl. They feel like they can consistently, you know, pick the best stocks. But it's important to know here that this is not the folly of weak minds. It's the folly often of the very most brilliant, sophisticated, articulate minds. Let me give you an example. Most of you know a gentleman called Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton invented a little thing we like to call gravitation or gravity. He is the father of all modern mathematics. He invented differential calculus. He discovered gravity and all its effects. And I'm just going to read you a small little excerpt from his masterpiece, Principia. He says, this is only one of about 100 different theorems. He says this: supposing the centripetal force to be proportional to the distance of the body from the center, all bodies revolving in any planes whatsoever will describe ellipses and complete their revolutions in equal times. And those which move in right lines, running backwards and forwards alternatively, will complete these several periods of going and returning in the same times. This is the stuff that rocket scientists use to calculate the trajectory of rocket ships and satellites and the space shuttle. Sir Isaac Newton lost nearly all of his wealth, 2,000 pounds, I guess back then it was quite a little money, in the South Sea bubble, which can easily be thought of as a very similar corollary to the tech bubble that many people lost massive amounts of their wealth. So here we have the person that invented modern mathematics, calculus, gravity, the movement of the planets, and he gets duped by ends up speculating and gambling his money and losing the vast majority of it. So I don't want people to think that this is something that weak minds or people that aren't intelligent fall into. I often find that people that are experiencing the traps are in a state of confusion. Often they're getting multiple brokerage statements or one big confusing brokerage statement that none of the items make sense. They can't tell often what was bought or what was sold, what the rates of returns were. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. They get these reams and reams of paper every quarter or every month, and they just can't make heads or tails of it. I also think a big key here is broken promises. If you feel like you have been implicitly or explicitly promised that you would get above market rates of returns, or you would have stellar performance, or you would, you know, based on so-and-so's past record, you were going to really do well. And some magazines will even go as far as in articles will say, get rich. You know, here are the four strategies to get rich now. You feel like you've been made promises, either explicitly told something or just implied through the brochures or through the conversation or through the analysis that you were going to get results that you simply did not achieve. Then good chances are you're in the traps. And finally, one of the most gut-wrenching aspects of these traps is that they often create a huge tax liability because of the excess of trading, buying and selling that's going on either internally in the portfolio or in individual stock trading. Trap number one, gambling with your money. And I want to make a distinction here. I'm not saying that all gambling is bad. If you enjoy taking some disposable income, going to Vegas or going to a casino or buying a lottery ticket, and that's money that you can afford to lose, you know, that may be an enjoyable activity that is valid for you as an individual. Where I take issue is when people gamble and speculate the financial wealth away that they need for their retirement and for their future. And the key distinction here is that because the brokerage community, the news programs, and the mutual funds, and the magazines all blur the line between speculating and gambling, most individuals are speculating and gambling with their money, and they don't even know it. They actually confuse gambling and speculating for prudent investing. How does this mistake happen? Well, this problem happens because the media and the financial community have a form of what I like to call an unholy alliance. You often turn on these news programs and you'll see so-and-so expert or so-and-so analyst or so-and-so person talking about their forecast for the future or what stocks they like. They'll actually say what to buy and what to sell, what to hold, so forth. The media needs this type of attention because that's what gets people to tune in. They need a continual forecast and prediction about the future to keep the people watching. They need highly speculative, adrenaline-driven, or fear-driven reports and stories to keep people turning in to keep the advertisers happy. Now, quite often in these news programs, especially the ones that focus on finance, guess who the main advertisers are? They're the financial community at large running ads on their mutual funds or their managers or their broker-dealer. I mean, this is really, truly the fox guarding the chicken coop here. In addition to that, the broker-dealers and the mutual fund companies and all the people that propose to have the ability to pick the best stocks going forward into the future, they need to keep this myth alive because that's what keeps their coffers full. That's what keeps you trading. That's what keeps the mutual fund companies money rolling into the mutual funds. These forms that we'll talk about, I'm going to talk about three of them, are three key warning signs that you are probably gambling and speculating with your money. Number one, trying to pick the best stocks. What's the next stocks or group of stocks going to be? But it's not only you doing it. If you try to hire a manager who proposes to tell you what the best stocks are, and most mutual fund companies are made totally out of this, you know, you hire a manager and they're supposed to buy and sell on your behalf to make you rich and make you a lot of money. That's the exact same thing. You aren't day trading, but in effect, many of the managers are day trading with your accounts. And the average turnover in an American mutual fund is 100% per year. That means that they're selling everything, wiping it all out every year, and buying brand new. And that happens year after year after year, and they're doing it with your money, even without your knowledge. Number two, timing. Trying to predict and forecast when to get in and when to get out. And this happens really by accident. People don't even admit they're forecasting, but let's say the market goes way up and they buy in and it's close to the top and the market loses a lot of money. People panic, they get out. And then they start asking, well, when's the right time to get in? When's the right time to get out? Is the market going up? Is the market going down? In effect, what they're trying to do is get in and out of the market based on a forecast of the future. Very dangerous. And the last way that you know you're gambling and speculating with your money is track record investing. Track record investing entails going with a manager much like betting on a horse, but going with a manager that had stellar performance in the past, maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years of beating the market, and hoping that they'll continue to do that into the future. All three of these types of speculation all entail a forecast. Someone is trying to forecast and predict what will happen in the future. Number two, mistaking a lot of stuff for true diversification. How does this happen? Well, people are led to believe that if they just own a lot of things, that they're diversified. So for example, if I go out and buy a collection of 100 different stocks and I get my statement and I have 100 different stocks on there, I might think, wow, I'm really diversified. Look at all these reams of companies. But if all of those companies are in one asset category, whether that's the S&P 500 or whether that's technology stocks or whether that's small company stocks, those assets are going to act very much alike. So when that market crashes, chances are you're going to lose massive amounts of your money. You know, we saw in the beginning of the 2000s, we saw people literally losing millions of dollars. We talked to many, many investors and we asked them, did you know that when one dropped, they would all drop? And they said, I had no idea. I thought I was diversified. I thought I had all these things in my portfolio. I hadn't. And we would ask them, did you know you could lose 40% of your money? Did you know you could lose 50? Did you know you could lose 70? We were always met with the resounding no. We had no idea. We were led to believe that we were totally diversified. Number three, mistaking activity for control. And boy, aren't we really encouraged to do this. We're led to believe that if we buy and sell and buy and sell and buy and sell, that we are in control. But if you go to Vegas and you get on that slot machine and you start dumping quarters in there or dollars and you start pulling the arm, are you in control? As a matter of fact, the more activity you create, the less in control you are. Because the odds are stacked against you. The more you pull the arm, the more chances are you're going to lose your money. Not the other way around. It's the same way in the brokerage community. The more times you pull the arm, which is to make the buys and make the sales and do the trades, each time you do that, a large part of your return is sucked out of the portfolio in the form of commissions and in the form of spread. So the more you're pulling the arm, the more you're trading, the more out of control you are, the less likely you are to receive good returns in a controlled, disciplined fashion. Now notice all three of these things make a lot of money for the brokerage firms. If you're gambling with your money, if you're mistaking a lot of stuff for diversification, if you're generating a lot of control, who's making the money? Number four. Believing all risks are equal. You know, many times we'll see someone doing something very imprudent with their money and we'll say, well, you know, you've got this $4 million and you only own four stocks and that's not very prudent. And then the investor will say, well, I know that it's very high risk, but risk and reward are related. Therefore, I'm taking all this additional risk and I will be rewarded. There's a big fallacy in that. And the fallacy is that all risks are equal. Risk taking for its own sake is a crime against self because it puts you in a position where your capacity to live fully and to enjoy your wealth is greatly diminished. Why would you ever do that? And yet we will see people time and time and time again take imprudent risk with their money and justify it because they link risk and return. I want to give you a distinction here to understand prudent risk from imprudent risk. Prudent risk is risk that has a high statistic probability using statistics, using academically sound understanding of markets and returns to give you a premium return over time. Translation? It's risk-taking that has a very high statistical likelihood that you will get additional returns for that risk. Imprudent risk-taking is risk-taking that has little or no correlation whatsoever with the likelihood that you will receive additional premiums or rates of returns for taking that risk. Distinguishing imprudent from prudent risk-taking is one of the investor's primary jobs to be a successful investor. Number five. This one's simple. Trusting your broker. So many people are led to believe by the commercials and the largeness of these financial institutions that the broker works for you. That is a misconception of grand proportion because the broker works for the broker-dealer, not for the individual. It's the broker's job to promote and sell what the broker-dealer tells them to promote and sell. The broker-dealer has a vested interest to maximize the profits to their owners of the broker-dealer. There's nothing wrong with that. Salesmen, saleswomen make this country run. There's nothing wrong with the act of selling, and that's the broker's job, is to sell. We just have to be smart enough to know where the conflict of interest is and not allow ourselves to be duped to believe we're getting unbiased advice when what we're really getting is advice that is self-interested. Number six, believing this time it's different. This is what I like to call the new paradigm problem. If we study history, we can see this time and time again throughout history. And we'll talk about recent history to make the case. We were all led to believe by the brokerage community, by the newspapers, by the media, by the TV shows, by the futurists, that we were in a new paradigm. And this new paradigm was that, look, and it made such a great story. And the story was that we're in a new paradigm because the future will be completely shaped by the internet. And therefore, if you just hook into internet companies, technology companies, these technologies are going to set the pace for the next 50 years. And there's no way that these companies are not going to be hugely profitable in the long run. Therefore, you really don't need to diversify into asset categories that have done poorly over the last 5 or 10 years because this is the new wave of the future. Not only that, but over the last 5 years, they've averaged, and this is just an example here, 20% a year for the last 5 years. And this trend is going to go out indefinitely because technology is the future. And it sounded great. It sounded great. Another thing that investors were highly encouraged to do was to buy all big blue chip companies. You know, invest in the Fortune 500 companies, big blue chip mutual funds, growth stocks. So buy growth stocks and technology stocks, and that's all you have to do to be very, very successful. Either buy those stocks individually or buy those managers that can tell you what the best stocks are in those asset categories, and you will continue to get rich indefinitely. The proverbial goose that laid the golden egg. What's the problem with that? The problem with that is it's not based in reality. The reality is that anytime you narrowly allocate your portfolio to one or two asset categories, you're setting yourself up for massive losses. Because if all those stocks had gone up together, guess what? When the market goes down, as markets always do, you can lose massive amounts of your money. And that's why the American public and the average investor was so decimated in the early parts of the 2000s because they had no idea they had loaded up on that much risk. The brokers didn't tell them. The magazines didn't tell them. The Wall Street Journal didn't tell them. The analysts on TV didn't tell them. No one championed the cause of the individual investor because the glut was on. Basically what they did, they sold us a bill of goods which said that risk and return are no longer related. These technology stocks are great. These blue chip stocks are great. They make huge 15, 20, 30% rates of returns a year, and there's not any risk in owning them. That's what we were sold, and that was the general illusion that we were led to believe. You saw books like Harry Dent's book called The Roaring 2000s. Every magazine cover talked about how 21-year-old kids were getting filthy rich and how you could too. This is nothing new. This was the same thing that happened in the Great Depression. This is the same thing that happened to Japanese stocks through the 80s. This is the same thing that happened to poor Isaac Newton, you know, a genius on par with Einstein, who lost a majority of his wealth in the South Sea bubble. And that's why to be a truly knowledgeable investor requires not just an understanding of the nuts and bolts, the X's and O's, the calculations. It also entails an understanding of what it is to be human. History, science, philosophy. And to be a successful investor also recalls a great capability and adaptability to look at self and self-knowledge through the process. Number 7, the I'll stop when I get even mistake. You know, I'll ask people, is controlling risk important to you? And they'll say, yes, absolutely. And I'll say, great. Can you show me an academic number, a study, a statistic that shows the amount of risk and volatility in your portfolio? And they get this look almost like a deer caught in the headlight. And I'll say, no. And then I'll hit them with the next question. Well, if you can't actually measure risk in any meaningful way, is there any way for you to control it? And of course, the next answer is no. I'll ask them, did your advisor or your broker, your financial planner, ever discuss risk or volatility with you and give you a scientific number, a way to measure it and compare it? They'll say no. I say, did you know that your portfolio would be this volatile and you could lose this much money in a downturn? And again, the answer is most likely no. In fact, I've never, to any of those questions, been told yes, and I've asked it thousands of times. In effect, what people have been told, and all of their brokers and all the financial planners say, well, risk is very important. You must always consider risk. And yet they give no meaningful way whatsoever to help people actually quantify and identify what risk is acceptable to them and what risk they want to take and what risk they want to avoid. What this leads to quite often are big losses in their portfolio. The next question I'll say is, if you took imprudent risk to get where you are today, this is something we need to solve. It's a problem that needs to be addressed. And then here comes the 7th trap. Ready? Well, you know, I want to fix the problem, but I'll stop when I get even. You know, I had $1 million. It's down to 500 or 400 or 300. And when it gets back up to a million or 500, that's when I'll stop. Now, you can even hear the compulsiveness and the obsessiveness in that statement, very much like a gambler who's down 10,000 in Vegas and says they're going to stop when they get even. And then I like to ask the investor the next question. When is the best time to be prudent? The investor responds, right now. And they're exactly right. If you thought when I asked you that question that the best time to be prudent is now, you are exactly right. Now is always the best time to be prudent. If imprudent risk-taking and speculation has cost you money, the worst thing that you could do is continue to take imprudent, speculative, and risk-taking activities going into the future. The opportunity here to avoid trap number 7 is to realize that you are not your decisions, and that just because you made an improper or imprudent decision in the past does not mean that you're less of a person or less intelligent. As a matter of fact, it's a sign of intelligence and growth to solve and put an end to a destructive process when you become aware that it is destructive. Now, another thing that makes all of these traps so compelling is that they're very seductive. You know, if somebody really could help you pick the best stocks and forecast which way the market's going to go, and all you needed to do was look at a ranking system and see which manager had done it in the past, and all you have to do is just check in your money with them and they'll continue to do it in the future. You know, if someone could actually do all this stuff, life would get real easy as far as investing is concerned because you would be making 20, 30, 40, 50% a year with no risk. And who wouldn't like to have that? But it's kind of like a belief in Santa Claus. It's just not founded in reality. And when you have a whole industry that spends billions and billions and billions of dollars a year to perpetuate the illusions, myths, and intellectual dishonesties that keep people speculating and gambling with their money, it's a very devious trap indeed.
Mark has detailed for you the 7 deadly investor traps. Number 1, gambling with your money. That can be stock picking, market timing, or track record investing, past performance. Number 2, mistaking stuff for diversification. Trap number 3, mistaking activity for control. Trap number 4, believing all risk is equal. That is, knowing the difference between prudent risk versus imprudent risk. Number 5, trusting your broker, believing the image of commercials that the broker is in it for you. In fact, the broker works for a company. Number 6, believing this time it's different. For instance, tech stocks and only tech stocks at the turn of the 21st century would equal wealth. And we know what happened when that bubble burst. And number 7, the I'll stop when I get even mistake.
The first thing I want you to remember as we go into these power strategies to eliminate these traps is that almost no one wants you to know the truth. Because if you know the truth, you're going to be able to stop all these very destructive activities and put the brokerage community and the financial community and the media at large out of business. But let's look at how you do that. Number one, eliminate speculating and gambling in your portfolio. You know, it's just as important when you talk about investing, it's kind of like a diet. You know, you need to eat the right foods on a diet, right, if you want to lose weight. But it's also important to eliminate eating the chocolate cake every night. Here, it's just as important to eliminate those imprudent activities. We must eliminate speculating and gambling with the money, stock picking, market timing, track record investing, chasing performance. You know, so many times investors will kind of sit on the sidelines while something goes up and up and up and up, whether that's U.S. large stocks or tech stocks or international stocks, whatever the asset category is. And then finally, after a period of huge returns, they'll get in and then they'll lose a majority of their money, panic, and get out. This is not just something that happens to other people. Let me give you an example. Dalbar did a study. They found out that the S&P 500 over a 20-year period averaged 12%. The average investor investing in mutual funds trying to beat the S&P 500 made 2.6%. Why? Because of their own behavior. They bought fund managers and mutual funds that would go through a good 5 or 10-year period thinking that it was just the fund manager when it was really the underlying asset category. They would lose 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% of their money, panic, sell, get out, and then repeat the same cycle over and over and over again. Of course, every time the cycle happens, making more profits and commissions for the brokerage firms that they're working with. So this is very, very crucial. Eliminate speculating and gambling from the process. Number two, use market forces, don't fight them. What do I mean by that? In a free market economy, the market works very, very well at giving investors rates of returns on their money. In fact, that rate of return is there for the taking. The way that you do that is by allocating the funds into something that's called a structured market portfolio. These are individual institutional funds that usually are available only to the largest Fortune 500 pension plans, the most sophisticated investors, that will buy a cross-section of a whole asset category. That might be 2 or 3,000 of the smallest stocks in the U.S., or that might be emerging market stocks, or that might be stocks in Asia or Europe. It's a cross-dimension of that market rate of return, and then the manager eliminates all speculating and buying and selling by owning that cross-section, and what happens is that reduces the cost exponentially and helping the investor to achieve a pure market rate of return. Most investors have no idea at all what an average market rate of return would be for various asset categories. Let me give you some examples. Just by owning U.S. microcap stocks from 1927 all the way through 2002, the annualized capital rate of return, 12.8%, almost 13%. No stock picking required just by owning that cross section. We look at the S&P 500 during the same time period, 10.2%. Small cap value stocks, 13.9%, nearly 14%. Large value stocks for that same period of time, 11.5%. Or how about international large companies from 1970 to 2002, 14.9%. Now, what is critical about this is that there is no stock picking at all. There's no forecast, there's no prediction, there's none of the gambling. You just own every single stock in that asset category. That's what we talk about when we talk about market rates of returns. Secondly, diversify. This sounds like the epitome of simplicity. And yet, almost no investors do it. Why? Because to diversify means that when you build your portfolio, you're going to buy some asset categories that just had great 10-year periods. But you're also going to be buying some asset categories that made almost nothing over the last 5 or 10 years. Because to have true diversification means to own asset categories with dissimilar price movement, meaning that when one crashes, the other ones have a good opportunity to be up. Because the financial planning and brokerage community is largely compensated based on commission, true prudence and diversification falls by the wayside. finally rebalance. To consistently, on a quarterly, annual basis, to look at the portfolio, find what asset categories are over their targets, sell off the excess in that, and then consistently buy asset categories that are down. Now, this takes a tremendous amount of discipline and a tremendous amount of fortitude because, in essence, what you're going to be doing is selling off the winners a little bit every year in buying more of the things that just lost you money. This is the opposite of what every instinct is going to urge you to do. Not only that, but it's also the opposite of what the news programs, the magazines, and the brokers are going to be urging you to do. Number three, fire your broker, fire your financial planner, hire a coach. Coming from the industry as a financial planner, coming from the industry as a stockbroker, what I can share with you from inside the industry is that financial plans are not created to give peace of mind to investors. The real truth is that when you go to conferences, when you go to conventions, all of the software vendors, all of the wholesalers, all of the people there sell the software for one thing, to help generate commissions for the broker. In effect, what happens is the software and planning process itself largely becomes obscured and tainted and used more as a system to push product down an investor's throat than it is to truly educate and help a client grow and an investor to achieve true peace of mind. This is a sad comment on our industry. I also wanted to put a caveat to that. It's not all like that. There are some very well-meaning people out there, do a great job, that make great recommendations. But the temptation at large is so huge when your mortgage, your kids' college, your own personal retirement plan, the tendency to skew recommendations based on the commission and based on what's best for the brokerage firm and for you as an individual financial planner is often too onerous to overcome. I firmly believe, you know, before I understood a lot of these concepts and ideas, that I was doing the best job I possibly could for my investors. Remember, I shared with you the story of using all those actively traded mutual funds. I have to be brutally frank, I was part of the problem. At one point, I was definitely part of this problem. I just didn't know any other way out. Whether you're using a broker or a person that calls them a financial advisor, because the recommendations can easily become so slanted and self-interested, it's critical that you use a coach. What's the difference? Well, what a coach does, first of all, is help you make the prudent decisions about how much volatility, what types of risk, help you to truly understand and measure diversification in your portfolio, takes the time to help you understand and work with you on what you really want your money to do in the future. What does your money really have to do to bring peace of mind for you? Investing shouldn't be a black box. Most people just buy some of this, some of that, some of this, and they really don't know the underlying dynamics or philosophy about what's going on in their portfolios. An investor will never have peace of mind using that financial planning system or process because to truly have peace of mind must be created between their ears, not in a spreadsheet or a complicated financial statement. The most common result that I see from the traditional financial planning process that's commission-driven is fear, anxiety, confusion, complexity, and a reduced ability to take action on your own behalf. What a coach does is helps you wade your way through all these very complex issues and then also helps you to maintain a long-term discipline around the investing process. Because ultimately, investing is a people problem, not necessarily a portfolio problem. So if you can think of it in these terms, a broker slash financial planner is truly part of the problem. The solution to that broker financial planning problem is a coach. Another thing that a coach will do is a coach will make recommendations based on independence, based not on commission, but based on the independence of the advice that the coach is doing the best thing in your interest. So here's the three power strategies. Number one, Eliminate speculating and gambling in your portfolio. It's an absolute must if you're ever to achieve true peace of mind. Number two, use the power of free markets. They're extremely powerful. If you fight the forces, you end up losing. If you use them and diversify prudently, achieve market rates of returns and rebalance, you have an expanded capability to have a fulfilling and satisfying investment experience. And finally, fire your broker, fire your financial planner, and hire a coach that's going to help you make all these decisions and truly achieve some peace of mind around your money.
Now, returning to our conversation with Leba Ostro. Leba, it seems a critical aspect, and you've talked about this, for your investor, your client, to have a coach like you guiding them rather than a salesman who's churning a portfolio for commission's sake.
The analysis of what I did to decide that I wanted to be framed as a coach for my workouts, I have a coach. Now, I know how to work out. I know how to pump weights. I know how to do Pilates. I sort of know how to play golf. But I have a coach for all three of those. And the reason is, number one, they make me more disciplined. The days I don't feel like getting out of bed, if I have a coach that's meeting me in the gym, I get out of bed. From a golf standpoint, he probably wants to fire me, but I really do try to do what the golf coach teaches me. And with Pilates, it actually just pushes me further in my limits, expands my knowledge, and keeps me on course. So I really believe in coaches, and so imploring that in my practice is already a natural transition for me.
Does it take a shift in thinking for your clients as well, who are perhaps more used to being sold by a salesman as opposed to coached and educated by a financial expert like yourself?
My clients have been coached already. They just didn't call it that. But when new people come in, I'll give you an example. When I was just listing my house for sale and the MLS person came to photograph the house, he said, "I'm not your normal photographer." And I said, "Oh, are you my abnormal photographer?" And he laughed. He said, "No, I'm actually the owner of the company." And I said, "Great." And we're chatting for a while. And finally he said to me, "Well, what do you do for a living?" I said, "Well, I'm a financial coach." He said, "Wow, what's that?" So I went in and explained what that was. He said, "That's wonderful. You mean you're not going to shove products down my throat?" I said, "No, that's not how we work. We actually help you design a portfolio that fits your timeline, your risk tolerance, your sophistication, your needs. And together we'll build this and we will coach you and educate you. I don't want either of you, not the husband, not the wife, to feel like they don't know what they have. You don't need to be me, but you need to comfortably know what you have and to be able to intelligently talk about it." He loved it. We ended up meeting for lunch a week later, and now he's become a client. We customize every plan for every different family, because one of the parables I've always said to people is, someone will always ask me, "Well, what would you do if you were me?" They actually say, "What do you do for your portfolio?" And I said, "I'd be glad to share that with you, but you're not me. So I'll share with you what I have, but I'm Leba, and I'm married to Stuart, and I have adult children and so on. So my needs and my sophistication is different than yours. But I will tell you that I'll design a portfolio for you that fits you as if I was you. And if it doesn't feel comfortable, it's not the right plan."
Now you know the traps. With the help of Leba Ostro, you can employ the strategies to avoid the traps and become a prudently coached investor building wealth. For an appointment, call 713-877-8095. That's 713-877-8095. Meet with success. Meet with the Ostro Financial Group and Leba Ostro.